regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Welcome to the Federal Society, IPTLA, and HLS joint event on pandemics and patents. Do patents help or hinder medical innovation? We're really glad to have you all here. So my name is Matt Moderman, and I'm the Federal Society and IPTLA president this year. The Federal Society is a nonpartisan, conservative, and libertarian organization dedicated to freedom, federalism, and judicial restraint. And the IPTLA is a student organization dedicated to advancing Akron Law students' education and careers in intellectual property law. Before we begin, I would just like to encourage anyone who is curious about the Federal Society or the IPTLA to consider reaching out to us at the emails on screen and joining through Root Connect, which can be found at that link or QR code. Membership for both is free and comes with a lot of benefits that we'd love for you to take advantage of. But moving on, today we have an excellent event planned. We're joined by two exceptional lawyers for a discussion on pandemics, patents, and medical innovation. The first speaker is Professor Adam Mossoff. Professor Mossoff is a professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. His research primarily focuses on the theoretical justification for and historical protection of patents and other intellectual property rights as private property rights secured to inventors and creators, and thus function as commercial assets in driving a growing innovation economy and flourishing society. His research has been relied on by the Supreme Court of the United States, the Federal Circuit, and other federal agencies. Professor Mossoff graduated with honors from the University of Chicago Law School and clerked on the Fifth Circuit. Now I will pass to the Health Law Society. I believe Annette Rodriguez is going to introduce our next speaker. So Annette, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, all. It's great to see you. And I know Matt had to work very hard, so I'm glad that we can see the fruits of our labor. Hopefully we'll enjoy it. Nice debate. Our debater, Professor Mossoff, if I should say, friendly competition, is Dr. George Horvath. He just joined the faculty at Akron Law, and I asked him to highlight some of his accomplishments for me. So he is, he spent 15 years practicing as a physician, and he changed careers because of his interest on how laws and regulations of federalism function as determinants of healthcare quality and accessibility. We agree on that. He got his Juris Doctor at Berkeley Law in 2014, clerk in the Ninth Circuit for Judge Noonan, and was a postdoctoral scholar and lecturer from 2016 until he joined the Akron Law Faculty this August. So welcome and thank you.
And finally, the moderator of today's event is Professor Camilla Hurdy. Professor Hurdy is an associate professor of law and director of faculty research and development at the University of Akron School of Law. Professor Hurdy's research has focused on the role of federal, state, and local governments in promoting innovation and economic development, the history of United States patent law, the law and policy of trade secrets and unfair competition, and the relationship between intellectual property law, innovation, and human well-being. Professor Hurdy, we are ready to get started, so please take it away.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Annette, and all student organizers of this event and all student attendees. So I just want to say the briefest of words by way of introduction to this debate. So this is a crucial time for the world, and the patent system is, for once, in the spotlight. There is a heated debate right now going on over the role of patents during the coronavirus pandemic. And for those of you who have not been following this, which is probably very few of you, I will just say this debate has two sides. On one side, some say that patents are in the way of progress. As you know, patents give an inventor a 20-year exclusive right, sometimes less, sometimes more, to their invention. If the inventor of a vaccine, a treatment, or a cure to COVID-19 obtained the patent, this would give them the right to prevent others from using that invention, and just as importantly, the right to charge whatever price the market will bear. And so this is why we see articles with titles like The Patent Problem in Bloomberg, How to Break a Big pharma monopoly, the New Republic, the COVID big pharma profiteers, Atlantic. The idea is that just at the time the world needs it most, somebody's going to slap a patent on the vaccine or cure, and that will stand in the way of public health. In contrast, on the other side, and Professor Moffat is one of the most important voices in this side, have argued that patents are part of the solution. In fact, the goal of patents, after all, is to promote innovation. The government doesn't give patents for no reason. Government gives patents to true inventors precisely so that they will spend the billions of dollars needed to invent, develop, and test the vaccine and cures the world needs. So these are incredibly disparate viewpoints. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have here my old friend and colleague, Professor Moffat, to represent viewpoint one, or rather viewpoint two, and equally thrilled to have my new friend and colleague, Professor Horvath, here to discuss viewpoint one. And as a patent expert and health law expert, respectively, they really could not be better poised to discuss these issues. So now I'm going to turn it over to Professor Moffat. He's going to have 15 minutes to represent his viewpoint. And then we'll move to Dr. Horvath, and he'll take 15 minutes, and then we'll have 5 minutes each for them to respond to each other's points. And then lastly, I'll reserve around 15 minutes going up to 120 for a couple questions myself and open it to the audience for Q&A. So Professor Moffat, take it away.
Thank you, Professor Hardy, and it's a real pleasure to be here. Longtime colleague of Professor Hardy's and huge admirer of her incredible scholarship and work. I'm very jealous of the students at Akron who get to interact with her every day, and all of the other great faculty members at Akron. And I'm really delighted to be invited to have this fun. I don't want to think of it as a discussion, as opposed to a debate. We're both coming to this, I think, with important points to be made. And the airing of these issues, I think, is something that Federal Society really does a really great job of doing, and providing a platform for showing this kind of vibrant marketplace of ideas that develops both in law schools and continues throughout everyone's professional careers as you go out into law and take various positions in our society as lawyers and policymakers, decision makers, and government officials. So I want to kick off a little bit by talking more generally about the role or nature of patents, and then drill down more specifically into the biopharma industry, and then talk about the current COVID-19 pandemic as kind of the structure of my remarks today. And so picking up very nicely from the excellent introductory remarks by Professor Hardy, that that a lot of people think of patents in terms of this kind of, or at least the conventional wisdom is this, this trade-off, or we're incentivizing people to invent by dangling this little carrot of a 20-year exclusive right, and we balance that against, of course, the restricted access that comes from that exclusive right after they invent, because then it falls into the public domain and we get more inventions and innovations overall, so on net we benefit. And that's kind of the classic framing of the trade-off of intellectual property more generally and specifically within the patent system longstanding. But I'm going to push back on that framing a little bit, because one of the reasons why I'm an advocate for patents, and I think patents are very important for not just growing the innovation economy generally, but producing a flourishing society where we have incredible medical treatments, including the types of treatments that are going to eventually address COVID-19 as they're currently are being developed and are now currently being deployed, is that patents don't just serve that function. Of course, patents serve an incentive to invent. Like all property rights, you dangle an exclusive set of exclusive rights in front of someone, that creates incentives for them to try to create the assets that will be protected by those exclusive rights. So, of course, farmers will farm as a result of a promise of a property right in the fruits of their labors. But you could do that with inventions with other things as well. We could offer prizes. We could offer federal subsidies. This is a great part of, this is a lot of what Professor Hardy explores in her incredible historical and contemporary research on these topics. But why do we secure patents as property rights? Well, because we're doing something more than just incentivizing to invent in the same way that a prize system would, or a federal subsidy system would, or a tax break would, or even direct tax benefits, or direct subsidies. Property rights serve a commercialization function. They provide an incentive to deploy assets in the marketplace. They are the subject matter of contracts. This is what people learn in both property law and their first year property law and first year contracts, that property is the subject matter of exchanges, and that they therefore are a platform for people to engage in interactions with other people, and moreover, to engage in new innovative developments themselves. And so patents aren't just an incentive to invent as a property right, they also incentivize people to come up with new commercial arrangements and mechanisms, things that historically have been things like patent pools, licensing deals, the incredible complex value chain that we now have in the 21st century that produces the incredible good that we all live with today, and it makes life in the 21st century a veritable miracle by historical standards, especially in the medical context. And this is really important to understand because patents, from the conventional wisdom perspective of just being, you know, the incentive to invent versus the restriction on access, they become an easy go-to, for lack of a better phrase, whipping boy. And in fact, the moment the COVID-19 was kind of breaking onto the scene, even in January and February, before there were any treatments for it whatsoever, people were immediately calling for restrictions on whatever patents that may issue from it. So starting in February, public officials were issuing letters, saying, releasing letters and statements saying, we should confiscate patents, we should impose price controls, we should do this. There weren't even any patents yet on any treatments, and they were saying that we should do this. And so this is really important to step back and realize that the reason why we have the type of medical system we have today, and particularly the biotech innovations that we have today, is because of the patent system. So these things have been driven by the patent system. It's been a platform for innovation, not just in terms of the treatments, but in terms of how these products and services have been deployed to people in the marketplace, in the healthcare market. And so this is very much why patents are the COVID-19 is not going to be a repeat of the Spanish flu of 1917, which killed an estimated, they don't know exactly how many around the world because we didn't have the types of record keeping we have now, but estimates sometimes range as high as 50 million people worldwide died from the Spanish flu pandemic of 1917. Tens of millions of people died. We're not going to have a repeat of that. I mean, a lot of people will obviously hurt. A lot of people have already passed away from this pandemic. But it's not going to be a repeat of that because we've had a biotech and medical industry, and the biopharmaceutical industry, that has immediately leaped into action. And the reason why they're able to leap into action is because for decades they have had reliable and effective property rights secured in their innovations. Now, of course, they've needed this because, as Professor Hurdy has mentioned, it's very expensive and difficult to do biomedical research. So current studies show that typically most treatments result from an average of 10 to 15 years of research and development across a long chain of initial exploration of compounds. Usually the estimates are they start with a range of around 10,000 compounds that they test. From that, you get approximately 250 compounds that result in preclinical testing. From that, you then get 5 compounds, molecules or therapeutic treatments that are tested in clinical testing, the FDA's phase testing, particularly phase 3 testing of human trials, which is the most expensive. And then from that, one compound is ultimately approved by the FDA by use in the healthcare market by patients. So this funnel of 10,000 initial compounds over the span of 10 to 15 years to one actually being made available to customers has led to the estimates that the average product that's sold in the marketplace, the drug, has an average R&D expenditure, sunk cost of around $2.6 billion. That's before the pharmaceutical company has made 1 cent in selling it, right? So that explains a little bit of the expenses, but that's not just about the initial upfront investments and expenditures, because they have to then develop the commercialization mechanisms to then deploy these in the marketplace. And they have to enter into licensing deals and information sharing deals between other companies in the industry, between biopharmaceutical companies and biotech startups and other industry participants. And this is why when the COVID-19 broke on the scene in May, they were able to, because of this existing infrastructure that they had of various licensing deals and information sharing mechanisms, they immediately had in May 430 compounds, diagnostic tests, and vaccines under research and development at various phases in May. And as of October, there are now 762, almost doubling of the total number of therapeutic treatments in terms of drugs, vaccines, and diagnostic tests that are currently being developed at various stages. And we've heard some of these have already, in fact, remdesivir has already been approved for use officially, and this is really significant. In fact, remdesivir represents exactly what I described. It arose from well over a decade of testing by Gilead, in fact, more than a decade. It was originally developed actually for other medical conditions, and they only discovered that it also has the secondary ability to treat a severe respiratory problems caused by COVID-19 infections. And it will ultimately came from well over $1 billion in R&D expenditures. And as I said, this is typical of R&D expenditures, and it's typical of the type of commercialization functions that patents serve when they are able to quickly then deploy this in the marketplace, as they have, and made it available to customers. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, patents, you know, are the easy go-to whipping boy because there are actually lots of bottlenecks in the industry. One should not deny that there are, you know, restrictions on access. But patents are the all too easy one to go to because a lot of the things that people complain about are not restrictions caused by patents. They're restrictions caused by other regulatory barriers. Regulatory barriers caused by the FDA. The lack of access to PPE was caused by FDA's refusal to approve new types of PPE and new types of manufacturer PPE. People discovered all of a sudden in the background that would have been working for many years with these certificates of need. You can't just build a new hospital. You actually have to get approval through a regulatory mechanism called a certificate of need in order to build a hospital to serve patients. So these are serious barriers that are imposed that prevent easy access and quick deployment of new products and services in the healthcare market. And moreover, there's just general problems in infrastructure more generally. This is often complained about in the developing world. You often hear that patents are a barrier to access in the developing world, for instance, for medical treatments. But this is actually untrue. Well over 90% of the top essential medicines identified by the World Health Organization are off patent. So why aren't these drugs making it to patients in developing world? Because, well, there's no infrastructure in developing countries to deploy these drugs. In fact, it's very common to hear stories of drugs sitting in warehouses rotting away because they lack the ability to distribute these drugs to the actual patients in those countries, either through actual delivery services. They don't have the roads that they can go on. They don't actually have refrigeration services to maintain vaccines and those types of capabilities. And that's exactly what patents secure for the innovators who have made possible a world that, as I mentioned, is a real miracle by any historical world standards. And I always love to tell this story to emphasize this because we've lost this perspective given the incredible biotech and biopharmaceutical revolutions that were spurred on by the patent industry. So a lot of people aren't aware of this. In 1924, President Calvin Coolidge's 16-year-old son died. He died in 1924 after injuring his little toe playing tennis on the front lawn of the White House. He died a week later because he got a blood infection. And antibiotics had not been invented yet in 1924. And so there was no way to treat him. And so the 16-year-old boy died after playing tennis. The son of the president of the United States died. It's just almost inconceivable to us. And by the way, notice this is 1924. This is less than 100 years ago, right? So this really emphasizes the significance of how far we have come, not just in 100 years, but only in just a mere 30 or 40 years, and that this is made possible not just by the ability of biopharmaceutical companies to recoup their R&D investments, but to take their property rights and go into the market and create very complex distributed value chains, licensing deals, information sharing mechanisms, and other types of things that are quite common. In fact, a lot of people know about these issues in other areas like the high-tech industry. You know, there are lots of different companies that contribute to a smartphone, the various components, and it's just as true in the biopharmaceutical industry. And this is why we will not have the same response, that the COVID-19 pandemic will certainly not be a repeat of the 1917 Spanish flu pandemic, and future pandemics will not be a repeat of those earlier pandemics either. And we have the biopharmaceutical industry to thank for this, and a very key part of it, not the only part, but a very key part of that was the patent system that has secured effective and reliable property rights in their innovations and creations that they have done. Now, I want to really end there, because I really want to engage in much more of a great conversation with George, so I'm actually going to end a little early and pass it over to him to hear his remarks.
Take it away, Professor Horvath.
Great. So, thank you for those remarks, and thank you, Camilla, and my thanks to the student organizers for this. This was it's been a lot of fun preparing for. So, I'm not going to dispute the utility of patents either as an incentive or as a means of facilitating commercial arrangements in the context of therapeutic development under normal, and that is non-pandemic circumstances. Many other people have made those arguments in the pharmaceutical context. Our arguments, have been made by many folks that there are costs and distributional consequences to patent rights that are normatively undesirable. And roughly the arguments go that vaccines and treatments are a public good, not a purely private commodity, and that the monopolies that patents confer allow excessive rent extraction, results in high prices, normatively undesirable distributional consequences, affordable vaccines not available to people in the global south, or even to historically disadvantaged folks in the U.S. These arguments have been made much better than I would make them. I actually want to explore two other arguments that are premised on recognizing the differences between the conditions that exist when we talk about the development of a treatment for a chronic disease, the more typical drug development or biologic development context, in comparison with the conditions that obtain in a pandemic. And so based on these different conditions that I'm gonna set out in a second, I really want to explore two arguments. One is that in this context, patents actually inhibit the development of vaccine within the time frame and at the scale needed to respond to a pandemic. And then the second argument, which is the one I find more fun, is that patents aren't even the best tool. They're not a necessary tool, and they may not even be the best tool to incentivize and facilitate the development of the new vaccines. And so, again, I'm coming at this from both the perspective of a former clinician and now a health law, not a patent law scholar. But what I want to begin with is just to distinguish set out four differences that distinguish the pandemic response context to the context in which a drug or a biologic is being developed to treat diabetes or cancer or high blood pressure. And I think that the four relevant differences that I would want to highlight are, the first is the need for speed. If you are developing a treatment for a chronic disease and you run into a delay, assuming that treatment would be a cure in the best case, there's an accumulation of harm to the people who don't have access to your new treatment. That accumulation is linear, assuming that the occurrence of the disease is at a steady state. But in a pandemic, the occurrence of disease is anything but steady state. And so we're now in our third period of essentially exponential growth in terms of the number of cases of COVID-19. Anything that delays the development and then the ultimate distribution of, and I'm going to focus on vaccines, of a vaccine, is going to have far more than a linear effect. The accumulation of harm will really be exponential. The second is the need for rapid scalability, unlike other treatments, in a pandemic, we really need to be able to produce hundreds of millions of doses to meet our needs. And that's hundreds of millions of doses just if we're talking about satisfying the U.S. need. If we're talking about satisfying global need, we're on the order of needing to produce 10 billion doses. And so anything that leads to underproduction of a vaccine, whether it's just the exercise of a monopoly right or anything that's capacity-based, again, you're going to see the same exponential accumulation of harm. Third is what I'm going to refer to rather inartfully as the distribution system. And what I mean by that is that when a company develops a drug or a biological to treat a typical disease, that drug is going to be sold through wholesalers, Medicare Part D, prescription drug plans, and a host of other market mechanisms. And there are going to be market uncertainties. The manufacturer really doesn't know how well the uptake is going to be for its new product. But what we've seen in pandemic responses in the last decade or two is governments that are negotiating pre-production contracts that are attempting really to buy up all of the available doses for distribution within their own borders. The United States did this for the H1N1 virus. It did this for the Zika vaccine. And so unlike the market uncertainties that exist in the more general drug development context, in some senses, the market for a pandemic vaccine is already established and locked in. The U.S. government's already contracted to buy hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of doses. And then the third distinction is that I think that there is a degree of uncertainty about the long-term need for a vaccine that's different than the long-term need for, let's say, a treatment for diabetes or cancer. Those are always going to be needed. Some infectious agents may well be eradicated once you get a vaccine program in place. Think about smallpox, right? We no longer have to be vaccinated against smallpox because it's been eradicated. Other infectious agents may become less dangerous over time. They may spontaneously mutate in the wild to a less virulent form. We as a population may develop a level of immunity either through vaccination or just through contact and infection. And we may alter our social practices in such a way that these agents become less dangerous. And I think the example of the Spanish flu is relevant here that right, we didn't have an effective vaccine for Spanish flu, but the pandemic eventually abated as we developed immunity. And so based on these four distinguishing characteristics, I want to look at two arguments. Right? So the first argument is that in the pandemic context in particular, patents can and indeed already have to some extent impeded the timely development of a commercially scalable vaccine. And so I think it's necessary to sort of explore what's involved in producing a vaccine in a little more detail and really to raise the concept of a patent thicket, right? And so the patent thicket, as I'm sure everyone is familiar with, right, it's been described, right, it's sort of this dense web of overlapping property rights, intellectual property rights patents that a developer is going to hack its way through, right, in order to be able to commercialize some new technology. And so the effects of having a patent thicket are that there are going to be increased costs of development as each company trying to develop a vaccine has to license the necessary components, methods, technologies, and so on. And there are transaction costs that also include just delays, the time necessary to make those negotiations. In an ordinary drug development scheme, this may not be so important. If it takes a company an extra few months to negotiate licenses that are necessary, yes, there'll be some linear accumulation of harm, but in the exponential growth in a pandemic that really has much different, a much larger magnitude of an effect. Then the question is, is there really a patent thicket in the vaccine space? And I think the answer is maybe. It's necessary to understand that a vaccine is really complicated, and no company develops a vaccine on its own. There are many, many precursors, many, many components, and many processes that are needed. If you're going the route that Moderna is going, creating a genetic material-based vaccine, you need a genetic sequence, and you need a process for converting that sequence of RNA or DNA into the proteins that are going to be the target for antibodies. And so you need these so-called reverse genetic platforms. If you're going the more traditional route that the other companies are taking, using a whole virus and either attenuating it or killing it, or just stripping off individual proteins to serve as the basis for your vaccine, you need those materials. You need a process to render those materials safe and usable. And then you need a process to generate either the DNA-based, RNA-based, or the viral-based vaccine to scale. So this may mean massive investments in cell culture or even chicken eggs. I mean, surprisingly, we're still growing vaccine materials, viruses in chicken eggs in the 21st century. You need components that can reduce the amount of these materials that are needed, so-called adjuvants, that trigger your immune response You need sometimes delivery vehicles called excipients, and you need delivery systems. And all of these basic inputs into vaccine development contain many subcomponents that are covered by many patents held by many players. And obviously, any roadblock with any one of those may delay development. And again, I can't emphasize enough that a delay of even a few weeks can have dramatic effects early in a pandemic. And even in the absence of a holdout, right, just the need to negotiate these issues is going to impose delays. And Adam has pointed out, I think there's been wonderful voluntary cooperation amongst the many players in the biotech field, but that doesn't necessarily mean that will continue in the future. And so the idea that patent rights need to be inviolable, I think it is a potential problem, not for the COVID pandemic, for the real pandemic that's coming. And I hate to say this, but I think this is one of our training wheel pandemics, that a much more serious pandemic will eventually arise. We've seen this issue come up in the Moderna attempts to develop a new technology-based vaccine. Moderna's been having trouble really since 2011 licensing a delivery system for its novel RNA-based vaccines. And so it's been locked in this patent dispute with a company called Arbutus that for a while threatened to derail Moderna's efforts. And so, again, I raise this to suggest that the rosy picture of patents as facilitating a commercial marketplace and as providing incentives is a little more complex. The more interesting argument that I want to explore is whether patents are really a necessary or even the best tool to facilitate the development of a vaccine. And to make this argument, I really need to put vaccine development into the broader context of regulation, capacity, and biology. And so Professor Moffitt has touched on some of the regulatory barriers that are faced. And I would argue that some of these regulatory barriers actually reduce the utility of patents. And so regulatory barriers, a company that develops a vaccine is not going to have a generic or a biosimilar competitor for either 5 or 12 years. If the patent's approved as a new drug, completely apart from patent-based exclusivity, there is a regulatory exclusive period of 5 years. So even if the patent has expired by the time the new drug is approved, there's a five-year period during which FDA cannot approve a competitor, a knockoff drug. Most vaccines are going to be approved as a biologic agent, and there my understanding is that it's actually a 12-year regulatory exclusivity period. And so there is going to be a period during which you won't face competition as a manufacturer. And even without regulatory barriers, it's not that easy for a would-be competitor to enter this market. It's easy to make a generic drug. All you have to do is get the same active chemical, show the FDA that that's all you're having is the same active chemical as a brand name drug, show that the labeling is the same, and show the FDA a study of 20 to 30 normal volunteers that show bioequivalence. And this was deliberately set up as a non-burdensome process to get competition through generic drugs. But for biosimilars, for biologic products like a vaccine that is supposed to be similar to a biologic drug that's been approved, each biologic product is going to be different, or you can't rely on chemical identity. And so the kind of submissions that are required require much more detail. They require evidence, more advanced evidence of pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic equivalence. And they require studies that show that switching back and forth between the reference drug and the biosimilar is safe and effective. And so I think that there is a much higher barrier, both by exclusivity periods and by regulatory approval requirements, to the entry of would-be competitors. And that's going to cover, as I suggest, about the first 12 years of the life of a new vaccine. All right, the second limitation is capacity. If you want to think about developing a new vaccine in the real-world context, as I said, for the United States market, we need hundreds of millions of doses. And it turns out there are a very small number of entities that have the capacity to produce vaccines at that scale. Vaccines that use the virus, attenuated virus, killed virus, to manufacture those, you have to need a very high level certification for biosafety. Very few companies have invested the resources into those kind of facilities. If you're talking about the kind of DNA or RNA-based vaccine like Moderna is developing, those have never been manufactured to scale. And so there are a very limited number of entities. Even if you wanted to say, look, we're going to let other entities enter the market, there just aren't a lot of companies that are capable of scaling up to compete. And then finally, biology. What happens after the regulatory exclusivity period elapses? And what I want to point out here is that there is a real possibility that any vaccine patent that's obtained today is going to be worthless in 12 years. And I want to contrast the COVID virus to sort of the kind of viruses that we've had a continuing need for vaccinations against for decades, measles, mumps, polio, and a couple of things that characterize those viruses. Their high so-called R-naught value, with R subscript zero. So R-naught is a measure of if one person is infected, how many people did they pass that infection on to? So if that person infects four others, the R-naught is four. And so these older, right, these other diseases, polio has an R-naught of 5 to 7, mumps 10 to 12, measles 10 to 18. Right, so every individual infected passes these infections on to many other people. It's much harder to get a population-level immunity, what's being referred to as herd immunity, when diseases spread that easy. For COVID-19, the causative virus was initially estimated to have an R-naught of 2 to 4. More recent estimates may be as low as 1.1 to 1.4. And so what this suggests is that once we achieve a sufficient level of population or herd immunity, either spontaneously or through vaccination, subsequent spread is going to be very unlikely. If one person gets this, there just aren't going to be the facility with which they can spread this and sort of engage in the kind of cascade that we're seeing right now is going to be much less likely. The second difference is that these other viruses tend to be very stable genetically.
I'm going to let you know you have about 2 minutes.
Good. I wrap up within that time. So these other viruses have been very stable. The poliovirus apparently hasn't mutated at all in over 60 years, and so what that means is that a vaccine that was created 60 years ago is still effective against each virus now. So what we know about coronaviruses is that they mutate like crazy. They're much larger viruses, they tend to mutate, and what that means is that whatever area of the current virus that you're targeting with a vaccine today may not be an effective target in 5 years or 12 years. And so the argument that I'm suggesting here is that patents may not be necessary to spur innovation for a pandemic disease like this, because a 20-year guarantee of market exclusivity isn't needed. In fact, the 12 years is probably enough, and even a shorter period of time might be sufficient, because all of the utility of the vaccine is going to come very early on. And so I think what's really needed is a set of short-term incentives focused on the first few years after a vaccine is developed, and many of these already exist. I've talked about exclusivity periods, regulatory barriers, government pre-production contracts. And so I would just suggest in this case that looking at vaccines as the tool looking at patents as the tool to get the vaccines that we need right now, we may not be looking at the right tool. So thank you.
And now each discussant has about 5 minutes to respond.
Yeah, awesome. So hold on, I'm going to turn my timer because you heard my timer go off before. There's a good, I'm still on mute. Am I still on mute?
You're good.
Oh, I'm good. Okay, good. So yes, because us academics like to bloviate too much, so I have to impose some external restrictions on myself. So I really appreciate it, George's comments. They were fantastic and really, also really, I think, well stated and and much more nuanced and appreciative of the institutional issues and the broader policy concerns that I think that we sometimes hear kind of in the broader discussions about these issues where people are just like, oh, patents, blah. So I really appreciate this, and it's because that's why I said I prefer to think of this as a discussion, and I think it is because there's so much that we agree on, and so I'm really delighted to focus on those issues that we maybe don't agree on, or maybe we'll find some area where we overlap with some agreement. So I was actually a little excited when he started talking about patent thickets. For those who may know me and know my scholarship, I am actually very famous for doing a lot of work on patent thickets. You can see behind me is an old sewing machine. I became famous by talking about one of the very first patent thickets that he developed, which was over patents on the sewing machine technology in the 1850s, and how they came up with a patent pool as a solution to this, because there's incentives to overcome patent thickets. And in fact, this is exactly what happens, is that in fact, because patents are property rights, they incentivize people not just to create, but to develop and deploy the commercial mechanisms like patent pools, licensing technologies, standard development organizations, information sharing mechanisms, and other types of commercial arrangements in the marketplace. You get the deployment of products and services, and actually very cheap products and services, very quickly and oftentimes with less cost than you may see. And the smartphone is a classic example of this. People were predicting a patent thicket would prevent the development of smartphones, that there would be holdouts, and these things should cost. In fact, the theoretical models that were framed in very general language about, oh, patents will hold out and they'll impose costs, predicted that our smartphones would cost tens of thousands of dollars, but they don't. They cost $1,000 at most, if not a couple hundred dollars if you buy a cheaper model. And these are incredible products, even though there's thousands of patents that cover them. And this really is exemplifies exactly the same type of things that occur in the biopharmaceutical industry. Although George focused on vaccines, I'd like to emphasize that it's not just vaccines. We're talking also about therapeutic treatments and diagnostic tests. That's part and parcel of the 762 current projects that are under our research and development right now, directed at COVID-19. But I highly recommend people going to the website, the COVID-19 Therapeutic Development Tracker, that's run by the organization BIO, the trade association for the biotech organization industry, which I got this information from. And it's fascinating because it provides all this wonderful information, like the fact that in May of 2020, there are only 100 vaccines currently under research and development at that time. And as of October of 2018, so it's just 6 months later, there's 193 vaccines, double the number of vaccines in just a mere 6 months. And so it's a really hard, and as I mentioned, there's almost a doubling of the total number of treatments being investigated more generally. So it's really hard to understand, like, where's the holdup occurring here? Where's the denial of services? In fact, this is lightning fast speed. This is being done at a level of speed of development that we've never seen before in human history in terms of the biopharmaceutical industry. And they're really explicit about this. This is made possible by the existing commercial arrangements that they had, that the existing licensing deals and information sharing deals that they had. In fact, it was great that George mentioned Moderna. Moderna delivered to the FDA at the end of January its vaccine. The end of January. And the processes and mechanisms that it had created to create that vaccine, it actually had not created to create a vaccine for COVID-19, but that they have been developed for other drugs and treatments. And this gets to be a very important point, again, what patents do, which is that they protect the ongoing development, commercialization, and otherwise, of the products and services that are being deployed in the marketplace. And so, as I mentioned, Remdesivir was not developed for COVID-19, but it's being deployed as a secondary use. This is known as secondary uses. The Moderna vaccine is another example of that, where they took technology originally developed for other things and are now deploying it for this. And again, this is what's made possible. It's why we talk about sometimes the patents being a platform of innovation and development. And this is exactly what you see. It's very hard to see that, you know, 100 vaccines or almost 200 vaccines being currently under development, almost 800 unique compounds in development, but anything is really being held up here at this point in time, even though theoretical models might suggest that actually may occur. So, turn it back to George.
Right.
Great, thanks. I know that I ran over, so I'm going to keep this quite brief. I think there are large areas of agreement. I appreciate that you brought up testing and therapeutics in addition to vaccines, and I do think that particularly in therapeutics, there's a different valence from what I described, because any treatment drug or biologic, not vaccine, but a treatment that's developed, certainly may have ongoing commercial application. And we've seen this, right? We've seen this with remdesivir, as you point out, right? I think it was originally developed as an Ebola treatment and is now being repurposed, albeit it's unclear how effective it is, but it is being repurposed as a treatment for COVID. And so there, I think the utility of patents over the long term, there's just a different valence there if there's going to be continued commercial applicability. The testing, I think, may fall somewhere in between. And then again, I would just point out that yes, the response by the industry in terms of patent pooling and all of it has been really amazing. I think it's been amazing to see. But there are potential problems. And so I'm not taking the position that, oh, look, we just need to abrogate patent rights. But I think that having a credible threat of that happening may be a useful tool in the future if you do end up in a situation where, look, we really need to get something developed quickly and there is a particular holdout. Other than that, I would propose that we open it to questions and see what comes up.
Great. All right. So as moderator, I've prepared just a couple of general purpose questions here. And so thank you so much, both for being so polite, but also for clearly preparing so well for this discussion. I just learned so much in the last 30 minutes. So my first question is, so as has been stated, the sort of strong anti-patent view here is that patents might serve as roadblocks at some point in the near future. And so with remdesivir, we see that Gilead owns a patent on it. And, it's been charging above cost for sure. But imagine, just to make this interesting, let's just imagine that a firm develops a surefire treatment or vaccine for COVID and charges, say, $5,000 per dose, significantly above cost. So let's just go there, okay? And let's imagine that governments around the world decide that this is something they really cannot afford to pay for and that their people cannot afford to pay for. Should the government intervene by either one of the two ways, either using a taking power / Section 1498 to simply ignore patent rights and allow creation of generics, possibly paying just compensation, or number two, assuming some of that research has been funded by the federal U.S. government, should government use its marching rights to literally ignore the patent and just use the invention? So that's really my question is, should and legally could government step in on this hypothetical exclusionary patent? And I guess I'll go first to Professor Moslaw, since I know he's written so much about the taking issue.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's the classic thing that we're all concerned about, right? So I appreciate the question very much. And what the first thing to note about it is what you described is not a patent problem because the tools, all right? This is why the condemnation power exists. This is why eminent domain power exists, and that's not a patent issue. That applies generally, to all types of property assets that exist in the United States. As long as the government has, the public, it's going to step in and take over and run the production and distribute the good and service, then that's the classic example of a government taking over anything for, taking a property and paying for it through just compensation. 1498. Now, I would say it's not permitted under the Hatch-Waxman marching power because that provision limits the ability of the government to step in only when it uses the language that when the patented drug is not being made available on reasonable terms, and that phrase has been consistently interpreted by bipartisan administrations for over 20 or 30 years as referring to the capacity concerns of the type that George described. So it's not like people are charging too much. And in fact, that's been explicitly rejected, as I mentioned, by bipartisan administrations starting from the 90s all the way up to now, that charging too much is a justification for the march in power.
And I just want to say for students who aren't as familiar with this issue, just know that this is a controversial issue. So just for example, Professor Jorge Contreras has said there's no rational way to say that this should be outside of the Vital Act, and he argues that the Vital Act was passed specifically to allow government to step in on research that government paid for. So just FYI, it's controversial, and Professor Moslev is giving one side of the issue.
Of course, that's what my side of the debate is. So I'll turn it over to George now, because I'm sure he will explore more of the other side. And
a different
George, and also point all the ways I'm wrong, which I hope he does.
Well, I, again, this is an area with which I am much less familiar. I would say that my understanding of the specific language of at least the implementing regulations, which I think just parrot what the statute says, for the Bayh-Dole, Martin writes, right, allows the government to intervene where, right, health and safety needs are not reasonably satisfied by the contractor. And so there, at least I think there would be some statutory and regulatory basis for that sort of intervention. And then just the question is the just compensation. I would also, as an aside, add that, you know, in terms of I took you back to the vaccines. I mean, the prices that are being quoted for the vaccines, I think Moderna has talked about, you know, something as high as $60 for a two injection course. But if you think about $60 to vaccinate 330 million people, that works out to just under $20 billion. In a year in which we've seen multi-trillion dollar bailout plans, that actually sounds like a bargain to me. So, Camille, you set up the much more challenging sort of the hepatitis B treatment scenario where, you know, there are these treatments that go for $84,000. And again, there, I think that at least the credible threat of an intervention is of some value.
Really good. So, thank you. I have so many more questions, and so I'm going to have to select among so many of my questions because I want to hear the students' views as well. But so one question is obviously about sort of, and George got to this a bit, is this really the time for patents, right? Patents, and Professor Moslev's telling, are really more of a part of a systemic, dynamic innovation ecosystem. But in George's telling, this is more of a sort of a black swan event where, hey, you know, we've got a global pandemic right here. And so some have argued that the government should, rather than allowing patent rights for these cures, vaccines, what have you, government should instead enter contracts and simply pay for vaccine development. So I guess, Professor Moslev, I'm a little curious to hear more of your response on why, just given this black swan, hopefully once in a century event, that isn't the more appropriate solution rather than giving exclusive rights.
Well, I mean, I don't see this as mutually exclusive positions, right? I mean, just like when you had the anthrax scares at the turn of the century, I love referring to the turn of the century being just 20 years ago, because for Professor Hardy and me and George and others, the turn of the century used to be 1900, not 2000. This was the issue with the anthrax scares and the antibiotics to treat that there were patents on them, Cipro, and the government ended up just negotiating to buy doses of Cipro to distribute in case anthrax actually became a problem and paid out. And so the patent doesn't exclude the government from negotiating. In fact, this is exactly what happens in current in existing Medicare Part B and through National Healthcare Services generally. in other countries and in our country, where government pays currently purchases more than 50% of all healthcare treatments, that they're buying from the owner of the patent. And how is that different from paying than taking it or setting up some type of other payment system where they're agreeing to pay them for their development or their research and development of it in a type situation, right? And in fact, I would say that now stepping back and taking a more kind of institutional perspective, I would say that it's probably better from my perspective, and I think generally, to maintain the existing structures and for the government to work within it, because that retains the viability and ongoing consistency of the law. So that patent owners and innovators aren't worried that, well, when an emergency comes around, everything, all the rules change. Because if that's the case, well, then you're going to significantly undermine the incentives for people to develop these issues, develop these new products and treatments, which sometimes, as I mentioned, takes over 10 or 15 years. So because they don't know what might be the response next time to the sui generis new novel approach of how they work out this arrangement for this new treatment in this emergency. And so I think that there are very strong kind of institutional reasons for why you should remain consistent and work within the existing structures. Like I said, this is why there's the takings clause and the eminent domain power. This is why you have a section 1498 to deal with capacity issues. I will say the language says reasonable, as George quoted from, but during the AIDS crisis, the exact issue was the AIDS treatments at that time were thousands of dollars, and this was the exact initial argument that this is not available to people. And the NIH, under bipartisan administrations, as I mentioned, responded by saying this is not the appropriate meaning of this term. Although this term has this meaning in other areas of the law, in the law, this term means something different. It means just capacity, not pricing.
Dr. Horvath, did you have a...
So I think that one of the distinctions that comes up is whether we're thinking about this issue in a U.S. context or in a global context, and I think that the question of intervention and how intervention might occur differs whether we're talking about a vaccine or a treatment. If we really believe that vaccinating the U.S. population will ensure that regardless of what happens in the rest of the world, the pandemic here is under control, then focusing just on the U.S., and again, just from a U.S.-centric position, focusing on the U.S. makes some sense. And I'm not arguing that a global perspective is not something that we should be adopting. But I would distinguish that from treatments, right? So if we're talking about remdesivir or we're talking about other treatments, it doesn't matter if we make sure that we have available an adequate supply of remdesivir if we're still not immune, if the pandemic is still raging around the world, right, it's going to create an ongoing need. And so I think that a more global approach is absolutely necessary.
So I, like I said, have a whole list of questions, but I think it's time to open it to our patient students and see what questions they may have. And so if you have a question, go ahead and raise your hand.
Judge Hull right now, if you'd like to unmute and you can go ahead.
Hey, Matt. Thanks so much, and thank you very much for a wonderful talk. It's a moving day here in Polk Chambers, so I had to step out for a couple minutes. But Professor Mossoff, great to see you, and Dr. Hobarth, it's great to see you, and thank you for an excellent question and answer here. So my question focuses on equitable remedies and injunctions. Maybe for Professor Mossoff, are you satisfied with the position of where injunctions are when it comes to pharmaceuticals, and does that create a bit of a middle ground? And then Dr. Horvath, what do you think about injunctions, and does that provide a middle ground for allowing for full patent protection, but then not allowing for equitable remedies and negotiated costs for the purposes of purchasing?
Yep. So, Jen Paul, awesome to see you as always, and thank you for joining us. So, it's a great question about injunctions. It's something I've been writing on. You've written on a lot as well before you became a judge, and it's a real concern or problem right now in the uh, in in uh, in the innovation industries more generally, what used to be a presumptive remedy in equity is no longer available really for owners of patents. Since the Supreme Court's decision in eBay, as Judge Holtwell knows, and many others, in 2006, has been construed in a way that actually has led to a significant reduction in the issuances of injunctions for owners of patents. And this is really significant because this devalues patents as an asset class. It makes it much more difficult to make the investments, not just in the initial R&D, in the kind of the R&D funnel that I described, but also in the commercial mechanisms to deploy these in the marketplace. If you don't have the injunction as the backstop, then there's not, and someone knows that they can always just get compulsory licensing or other types of price controls imposed upon you, then that's not a free market negotiation anymore. And that leads to serious concerns about undermining the proper incentives that the patent system is supposed to ensure, as well as undermining the ability for people to make the types of long-term investments that they need to do. So it's a real concern. It's unclear to what extent it's impacting the biopharmaceutical industry in the same way that it's impacting the high-tech industry and universities and individual inventors, which has been demonstrated to be very marked, but there has been some impact, and it does need to be addressed, and hopefully they will restore the injunctive right back to patent owners in the coming years.
I unfortunately have very, very little to add in this area. I haven't looked at this at all. The one thing I would ask is whether the option of infringing and then with a back-end remedy in a situation where speed is of the essence might not be a reasonable approach.
So that's a mild-mannered way of saying you think damages would be appropriate versus an injunction?
Again, it's not an area that I've looked closely at. I would say that off of the top of my head is a soft yes.
Yeah. I mean, we know that Justice Breyer would think that, and he's still on the court. And so, Judge Holt, thank you for raising the injunction versus damages question.
Yeah, thank you for your thoughts.
Really important to think about. So students, we are actually verging on time. Matt, should we give the students the ability to chime in, or how are we doing?
Out of time. I know classes, including my own, begin just in 8 minutes now, so we're going to need to log out here. But I also don't.
All right.
It is rather important. I would just like to thank Professor Mossoff for joining us from GMU today, and Dr. Horvath for joining us as well, and Professor Hardy for moderating for us. I thought it was a great event and really interesting and especially timely given where we are with vaccines right now. So thank you very much. Thank you to HLS for co-hosting. And with that, we will depart.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.